At that moment, the veil of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. The veil or curtain of the temple was a heavy cloth which separated the Holy of Holies from the rest of the temple. It was understood as the particular place of God's presence. And the high priest would have been permitted to enter the Holy of Holies only once each year to atone for the sins of the people. And so at its most basic and traditional theological level, this image of the veil being ripped apart from top to bottom is an image of any barrier, any separation between God and humanity being removed. Atonement or forgiveness is now freely available to all, and the presence of God found anywhere and recognized wherever life is given out of death. But there's another level of truth being unveiled here. In this most futile and horrible of deaths, Jesus unveils all the mechanisms by which we do violence to one another, and perhaps especially the ways in which we tend to seek to sacralize that violence or make that violence holy. Now, in contrast to the pornographic film made by Mel Gibson some years ago called The Passion of the Christ, Matthew's Gospel does not dwell on the immense suffering inflicted on Jesus in this most ghastly form of capital punishment. This was one of those times when we did best if we skipped the movie but read the book. Here we go straight from "they led him away to crucify him," almost immediately to "when they had crucified him." That's how much we get of the suffering. We do, however, dwell on how various crowds engaged in the kind of mocking that can only come from groupthink. The soldiers, the bandits crucified with him, those who passed by, and of course the chief priests along with the scribes and the elders. No one is clean here. Certainly not any of us. It's clear that for Matthew, the pain and suffering is not the point. The earth-shaking, life-giving unveiling is the point. Jesus' absolute integrity, even wondering why he is forsaken by everybody, integrity even unto death, is the point. And what is being unveiled in this most terrible of stories is the ugliness of all the ways we do justice, we do violence in the name of something good. Justice, controlling the uncontrollable, exacting a price for wrongdoing. We also do violence in less obvious ways to one another as we seek to manage our anxiety. Some of you know I spent some time over the last few years with the parts of the church in Tanzania. And the missionaries who taught the faith in that country in the East taught a kind of high Catholicism, with the effect that today in the cathedral in Dar es Salaam, you could be forgiven for thinking that you traveled back in time to pre-Vatican II Rome. And in the West, by contrast, the missionaries were from the evangelical or low church wing of our faith. And when the Holy Communion is celebrated in the Bishop's Chapel in Kasulu, the one presiding stands at the north end of the altar, making clear that he is not an intermediary in any sense, and wearing cassock, surplice, and tippet, and thus avoiding liturgical vestments and avoiding any hope of hint of creeping popery. Now, these were the struggles of the 19th century, and they're still being enacted in 2017. On one reading of history, it's clear that as communications improved and Anglican Christians in Tanzania came to know each other, they came to know each other as different, and different from each other in some important ways. And that naturally created tension in the relationship. Are we doing things right? What are those weirdos up to? How on earth are we ever going to get along? Well, what they have done, in part, is what most of us do, actually, when we have anxiety in a relationship. They focus on a third party, which allowed them some sense of togetherness without really having to deal with the underlying tension. In recent years, that third party has, you'll be pleased to hear, been us, the Episcopal Church, and our support of gay people, those dreadful people in America. We can all agree on that, and so we can feel a sense of togetherness. It happens a lot in our world, actually. Think about a couple who might be sensing that all is not perfect in their relationship. Very frequently will focus on their problem child, and that poor soul will bear the weight of all the anxiety in the family and will soon become symptomatic, maybe failing in school or getting sick or doing drugs or whatever. Isn't this exactly why the Jewish and Roman authorities colluded to have Jesus executed? The Romans were afraid of rioting and revolution. The Jewish authorities afraid of repressive reprisals. This death of Jesus was in both their interests. Jesus bore the sins of the world in the form of that mechanism by which we manage anxiety by triangulating a third party. And that is violent. Sooner or later, that is violent. Triangulating a scapegoat, if you like. And Jesus, in his integrity, took it. Forsaken by all who bore God for him. His friends, his community, the people in authority who were meant to serve justice and truth. All of them. And it's not just about them. Can you see? All of us. My God, why? Why? He participated in our life, even unto death, so that we can be freed from all those ways in which we are trapped and stuck in this everlasting cycle of blame and violence and anxiety and despair. Now we see we don't have to keep on doing the same old thing. We don't have to keep on trying to snuff out sparks of divinity when they are incredibly discomforting to us. Because when we see sparks of divinity, it functions a little bit like a mirror. And we don't often like what is reflected about us when we see ourselves in it. There is nothing holy, and there is nothing redemptive about violence ever. Even though many Christians have tried to make it so over the centuries. The God who would inflict such ghastliness on any creation, let alone the one who is called the Son, that God is not worthy of worship. One of the things we learn from the story of the sacrifice, putative sacrifice of Isaac, is that human sacrifice is over. It is to be no more. It is not of God. And so to turn around and say that somehow the death of Jesus is a human sacrifice is obscene and wrong. This story is not about holy bloodletting. It's about God with us, Emmanuel, sharing in our life, sharing in our death, so that we can see what integrity looks like, what an integrated life fully connected with the source of that life looks like, fully connected with the love that made every single one of us for the purpose of love, and which means that every single one of us is of infinite worth and infinite value. And as much as God participates in our condition and circumstance, so we are invited in turn to participate in godly life, turning our backs on all that is deathly, turning toward the light of a new day and a new creation, turning away from doing violence out of our anxiety and imagining that any good can come of it. This Friday is not good because of a violent execution, but in spite of it. There is, of course, much more to be said about that invitation, but that will have to wait till Sunday. For now, like the soldiers at the foot of the cross, all we can do is marvel. Then Jesus cried again with a loud voice and breathed his last. At that moment, the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. The earth shook, the rocks were split, the tombs also were opened, and many bodies of the saints who had fallen asleep were raised. And after his resurrection, they came out of the tombs and entered the holy city and appeared to many. Now, when the centurion and those with him who were keeping watch over Jesus saw the earthquake, saw what took place, they were terrified and said, "Truly, this man was God's son."